Okay, my name is Itir and I'm a geophometer from Melbourne, and I'm here with Rujumai, and we're doing a little conversation for the 50 Years, 50 Voices project. And there's quite a lot of questions I want to ask around change, but a good place to start is, how did it all start for you, Rujumai, your Dharma adventure?
In terms of the Melbourne Buddhist Center, I was 18 and I was just sort of looking for answers, really. I wanted to meditate, so I came along to a meditation course and then Buddhism. But I was quite obnoxious as a youth, and even before that I'd been kind of interested in Buddhism and read a bit about the Dalai Lama. I gave a talk about him in high school, and I went and heard him speak at the big tennis centre in the city.
Wow.
I was lucky that my parents didn't have a don't talk to strangers policy, so they sent me off to the city, sort of a 15-year-old, and went along and heard the Dalai Lama, and just I was really blown away by everyone's respect for him and just the sort of his sense of calm. So I think it was his manner that continued to kind of tweak my interest.
Wow.
And yeah, as I say, at 18 I came along to the centre.
Do you have a memory that, you know, this is significant, this is how it started? Or was it more like just a process that just happened on its own?
I think it was a sort of fairly steady path. I can't think of, you know, three or four pivotal moments where everything shifted. I mean, what I kind of read of the Dharma and what I heard made sense, and I was kind of on board in a fairly straightforward way. I had this idea of religions causing war and stuff and was a bit of an intellectual, but that dropped away pretty quickly because it just, in a way, I couldn't argue with my own experience of it.
Yeah. And what was your own experience?
Of just the truth. No one was kind of sugarcoating things or trying to give me priorities that I didn't subscribe to. I think there's a real framework for transformation in the direction that I was looking for. I was surrounded by young people who wanted to get a good car and a career and, you know, a house and a family. And there's, you know, there's nothing wrong with those things in themselves, but I was looking for something a bit different.
Yeah. And who was the first Order member who really met you, who, you know, you felt seen by?
Buddhadasa.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. He was taking the CAE course that I did. So it was like a centre run, a course run by the centre, but in an adult learning place in the city. So he took that. And then I think there was like 1 week off, and then the next week I was in at the Melbourne Buddha Centre for the Buddhism one.
In Pitt Street or here?
In Pitt Street, yeah.
Yeah,
our former centre.
Okay, yeah. And then so straight after that you went into the Buddhism course, and then what happened?
It's a bit hard to say.
Do you remember your first retreat?
I remember, you know, I remember meditating and finding it incredibly difficult. I found it difficult even just sitting still. But I could also see the effect of it. And I had a real confidence in it, I suppose. And I felt the same with the Dharma. I mean, I didn't necessarily find it easy, but it felt right. So I just kept kind of digging, meeting more people, going on retreat, as you say. I went on a weekend retreat up in Millgrove, one of the places we used to use, and then just, yeah, gradually threw myself into various aspects of it.
And what about ordination? Do you remember how that came about? When did you ask for ordination, and how was the process?
I think initially when I'd heard about all that side of it, I thought, oh, I'd like to go on longer retreats, and that sounds interesting, and the study and all that. But my motivations were probably a bit clearer by the time I actually asked. But I suppose I wanted a kind of fuller Dharma life, and it seemed like a way to commit my energy to it, to do it with others, and yeah, to just deepen my practice and challenge myself. So I went on some, you know, amazing retreats in New Zealand and up in Sydney. We'd have week or 2 week training for ordination retreats on various themes, and, you know, often it'd be with people who I wouldn't see for 2 years in between, but we had this really strong connection and almost like sort of stepping into another realm with these intense retreats.
And what did ordination feel like? And have things really changed since that? Because that was how many years ago now?
Three?
3 years ago.
Yeah. In some ways, it doesn't feel that different. Mm-hmm. I do feel... It did feel significant. Mm-hmm. But I think my kind of joining of the order was reasonably smooth, mm-hmm. and I felt confident in it. I had a year between knowing I would be ordained and actually going on the retreat.
Wow.
So it was plenty of time to kind of... It certainly wasn't a surprise or a last-minute kind of thing.
Yeah.
Mm. And I took a pretty long time to train. I'd have lost track, actually. People often like to know how many years. Mm. Lots.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what does your name mean?
Riju Mai means filled with integrity.
Mm. And how did you receive that name? What was your initial response to your name?
I just loved it.
Mm.
When I first heard it, I thought, my first split second thought was, oh, that's sort of pronounceable. I can manage that. And then when I heard the meaning, I just, fell to pieces, basically.
Mm.
I felt very met and... Yeah, Dharmanandi completely nailed it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just something I valued wholly, so.
Right. Mm. And it's been a short while, relatively, but has your relationship to your name changed?
I'm not sure if my... Yeah, I think it has in a way, and I guess you get asked what it means and, you get questions about it, so... Probably the way I relate to it in expressing it's changed a bit.
Mm.
I almost felt a bit shy saying filled with integrity because people would be like, oh, that's a lot of integrity, not like a little bit. You want to be like, is that the aspiration to be completely?
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, yes, that is a tall ask. Mm. But, there's not that many things that, you feel really deeply within you, if you say you'd die for or whatever, the things that you really, really take to heart.
Mm.
So I feel in a way, yes, it's something that's been recognised in me. Yes, it's something to aspire to, but also sort of bridging that is just something that I really treasure.
What about your relationship with Bhante? How has that evolved since your early days?
Yeah, I think early on he was, in my mind, he was, a founder and an academic, and he was the guy who wrote the books and, whose talks I listened to. So I was kind of receiving the Dharma and the information, but I didn't have a personal relationship with him.
Mm.
I feel like in more recent times I have... a kind of connection to him, which is sort of stronger than seeing him as the founder of our order or the writer of these amazing texts.
Mm.
And when we were at Astana a year before last, I didn't formally get to meet him because he wasn't well, but I did get to sort of see him briefly a couple of times. And so that was lovely.
Oh, lovely.
And just, I think, being on the course and studying Three Jewels, being, living where he was living, and we really seem to connect with that aspect of the order.
Yeah. How was the course? It was a three-month Dharma. What was it called, the course?
Maybe it was called an order course.
Okay,
because it was all order.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm. And it was 3 months, was it?
Yep.
And how many people were it?
There was 8 of us.
Wow, yeah, similar to the Dharma Life course, yeah.
Yep.
How did it go?
It was amazing. It was just one of those, once-in-a-lifetime things.
Mm.
Having that time out of kind of day-to-day life and living at Astana, I just love the place. It's something incredibly... magical and inspiring, just the energy that's gone into that project, what's been created. I mean, it's is fantastic. Mm. I mean, the course itself, the material and the retreats and that kind of thing, living together, that was great too. But I think, you know, half of it was for me just, you know, living at Astana. I mean, seeing, you know, 200 people arrive on a Friday night and be, you know, given the information off to their rooms and settled in, dinner, and then in the shrine room hear them chanting in those masses, you know, a couple of hours later. It's quite a remarkable place.
What about changes in your practice? I wonder if there are any views that you can comfortably say that you have seen through, or at least named, you know, anything that you can say, yeah, that's something that has really changed in me over the years.
I think the most significant change in me has been getting more in touch with my emotions and being more connected with others. Yeah, I mean, early on I was quite a tough nut to crack, very quiet and really... In a way, it's not that I discounted the importance of Sangha. It's just that I didn't even understand the significance of connections enough to value it. So, you know, as I kind of, my friendships grew and as I grew, that shifted, and I've learnt to trust and be more open, be vulnerable, challenge myself to, you know, communicate more fully. So, yeah, there's been other things, other changes, but I think that's the most radical shift in me.
So the Sangha jewel, you'd say?
Yeah, the Sangha jewel. It's hard to separate them out, but, yeah.
What about anything you can observe in newcomers? Any obvious pitfalls or struggles you can see that people go through, kind of like a rite of passage? Do you have any observations like that that you can see often people fall into these, I guess, reactive patterns or difficulties?
I think the thing that I sometimes feel myself jumping on the soapbox for is just not to waste time. Like, you know, people come along, they do a meditation course and they vanish for a few years and then they come back and say, oh, I was a bit busy or whatever. I mean, the time needs to be right. We need to be genuine in our practice. But there's just not time to waste. So often when I meet young people, I try to get that across. I'm not trying to sort of drag them kicking and screaming, but if people are willing and they're open and they're ready, then I just sort of say, you know, it's later than you think. Do it now.
Has that been something that you have seen through your involvement with young people? Because you've been involved with the young Sangha for a long time.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I've seen it with across the board. I don't think that's unique to any age group. I think it's just, you know, we can put things off, you know, we procrastinate or we prioritise the things that are urgent in the week but don't give enough time to our friendships and the sort of person that we want to become, how we want to practice and serve others. So, yeah, but, I mean, it is, I suppose, it is the sort of a lot of the young Sangha that I've kind of prioritised my time with, so I have seen it there as much as anywhere else.
What does going for refuge look like in your day-to-day life?
Well...
That's an easy question.
Yeah, it's just a small question. Well, I get up in the morning, I make two cups of tea, and then we drink at the tea. Manjusita usually stretches. Sometimes I stretch. I'm a bit slacker. Sometimes I watch. And then we meditate. And Then I go about my day, I go to work. I try to be as kind as I can.
Mm.
I'm very task orientated and I'm very systems focused and effective.
Mm.
So, you know, I work against my tendency to put the task ahead of the people. And, yeah, I just try to make skillful choices and be aware of what I'm doing, the impact I'm having. I then usually ride back home again, make tea. Depending on what night it is, it might be going to help with mitra study or chapter. Mm. I'm in a chapter that meets on Monday evening, so it may be that. Mm. Or just spending time with people, reading my book, going for a run. It's hard to separate which bits are sort of the core of my going for refuge from which bits are just supporting my lifestyle to be happy and healthy. Because you need a foundation for practice. So I used to probably neglect some of those things a bit, but I do really try and keep fit and eat well and that kind of thing.
Has the meaning of the centrality of going for refuge changed for you over the years?
Not really.
Mm. It was something quite straightforward for you from the beginning.
Yeah, it always felt straightforward.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know if I've been unduly confident, but, I mean, so far things have worked out. And quite early on when I took up with a boyfriend, someone said, oh, I hope it's not going to affect your going for refuge. And as a sort of 20-ish year old, I said, oh, I don't feel that anything could affect it. I feel I feel sure. So maybe there's a blindness in that, but I guess it's always felt right, and I just keep on doing what I'm doing. There's times where maybe I haven't given up enough energy to my practice, or I've been down or whatever, but I keep sort of getting myself back on track because I see it's the way.
It sounds like you've seen that since, from a very young age, 20. There are not many 20-year-olds at the centre these days, that's fantastic. Wow. This is an interesting question. If you had your time again, what might you do differently?
Gee, I think it would have been good to take a longer period out, maybe sooner. I mean, through my training for ordination and the first years of my ordination, since ordination, I kind of worked through and, it was fairly local. I'd done a couple of stints in the UK, survived a Christmas, in a shop and all that kind of thing, like a lot of the Aussies did back in the day. But that period at Astana, I think part of it was just like a sort of sabbatical, really, and just the benefits of that. So now knowing what I gained from that, I mean, provided I had the supportive conditions for it, I think, maybe when I was 25 or 30, I could have, spent 3 months out or 4 months out and just, gone and swept diamond undies floors and did study or did some stints of solitary and some periods of retreat. I've always, enjoyed going on retreats and going, doing study and that kind of thing, but there's something about intensive periods of of just a really different life.
Do you have any plans for the future around more intensive practice?
I'm going to do a solitary this year. I did one short one last year and I want to keep doing one, try and keep doing one each year, even if it's a week, ideally more. I think that really does consolidate my practice and just help me take stock. But I think this year most of the intensity and challenge is from keeping things simple locally. I'm really excited about being in high schools teaching meditation and just helping with mitra study. Things like that are what is kind of inspiring me. So, you know, some years I have gone off to the UK, or I have gone on a longer retreat in New Zealand, or, you know, done something new. Feels like this year is the year of just really getting behind what it is I how I want to live my life, and doing what I can in small ways here to make the Dharma available and to work with young people and stuff.
Yeah, in terms of the future and what would you like to do in the future, I have a question. It's about if you were able to leave a message or a term, a teaching or an image for future Dharma fairs, what would that be? Do you have a, you know, something that's really important to you that you, you know, you wish you could pass on somehow?
Might sound a bit obvious, but the Buddha. I mean, I just think reading, you know, reading one or two suttas, seeing an image of the Buddha, even the stories of his life before he was enlightened, nothing speaks more than the example of the Buddha and, you know, the inspiration of that and my connection to him has probably been one of the most significant things. There's lots of great bodhisattvas and images and stories and teachings, but you can't go past the Buddha, really.
No, yeah. The question is, what makes your heart to sing, your heart wish? If you were to put that in words, what would that be, your, you know, your longing in life?
Well, you mentioned earlier about young people. I mean, I think that's been my strongest passion for the Sangha in the last, you know, 7 years, I guess. You know, it's like that Dharmapada verse, now is the time to wake up while you are young and strong. It's not about just we want the future of Triratna to be secure. We want young people to benefit from practicing. So I feel like that's, you know, one of the most important things that I've done in my order life, one of the things that, that I feel most compelled by, I guess.
It's building that up.
Yeah, building that up and I suppose I used to put, you know, pressure on myself a bit, you know. I'd kind of look around and think, well, there's so few and we need to do something and it's me. And I had a friend doing, you know, organising things with me initially, Shane, and we had a great time, made lots of mistakes, learnt a lot and overall did a really good job. Then I was doing it on my own and kind of trying to carry a lot. So I've sort of gone through different phases at different times and I guess approached it better as I've gone along. But it's one of the things that I just keep coming back to as being really important to me. And I suppose, like you say, it's not typical for, you know, someone in their 20s to be sure that they want to dedicate their life to the three jewels. But I have absolutely no regrets. So to have that opportunity available to others feels like a privilege.
I have one last question, unless there's anything else you'd like to add or answer. And what do you think about the bodhisattva ideal? And where do you see yourself in relationship to that, and also the order in relationship to the bodhisattva ideal?
The beta set for Ideal, I mean, it's a bit hard to fault it, really. But I think, I mean, I'm not sure if it's a very popular word, but I sometimes think in terms of service.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes when you're running a retreat, people say, oh, you know, so-and-so is doing so much work for the retreat.
Mm-hmm.
They're not getting much of a retreat or a break. And I just think, well, this is a different experience for them. This is an opportunity to be of service. And I've taken a lot of those opportunities and grown a lot from it. So whether it's sort of the way we interact with someone we meet on the street or the way we contribute to the Sangha in practice or some sort of more internalized transformation and reorientation, I think it all ties into the Bodhisattva Ideal. And, yeah, I guess we call it different names, but I think it's a key teaching in our community.
Fantastic. Thank you, Rujumai. Any last comments or anything you'd like to add?
No. I think I've survived quite well.
That was fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you.